Broadcasting live from South Texas, this is your Petardcast. I am your host, Mr. Leonard Pierce, ruthless voice of the establishment, and it's time for another journey deep into the American ego. Joining us for this excursion is Mr. Hollywood Steve Huey, host of Yacht Rock, music aficionado, and VH1's most beloved counter-downer. And together, we will make this the Petardcast's most 15th episode ever. We'll also feature an all-royal wedding installment of Celebrities Are Our Betters, more disturbing revelations from my past, a tour of rock and roll hell, and more comedic material than you could find while emptying a pretty funny dumpster. Let your freak fly flag, my darling mistakes, because this is your Petardcast. As we often do on this podcast, we're going to take another look at Titbits, the column that I wrote for the New York Times up until 1989, when I was fired for being an imaginary person. Sometimes when I couldn't come up with a good idea for the Titbits column, I would just earn my weekly $6,000 fee without having to do anything difficult by taking a look at a few of the rarities in my comics collection. Not the really good rarities like Captain America number one or that issue of Blackhawk where Chop Chop punches Chuck in the neck and calls him a cracker, but the short-lived comics whose only claim to fame is the size and scope of their failure. So we're going to do one of those this week and look at some of the tunes that Time forgot. The first one in the pile here is Fightin' Italian-American. This quasi-patriotic hero debuted in the late 70s and lasted only 6 issues. In each, a gainfully employed legitimate businessman named Francisco Colasetti would don the garish red, white, blue, green, and red togs of the Fightin' Italian American to break up a different organized crime ring, one usually operated by Asians, African Americans, Greeks, or hillbillies. At the conclusion of each adventure, pompous District Attorney Gaylord Waspington would ask him why he never went after the Mafia, and Fightin' Italian-American would respond that it was a myth. Groovy Monster Hot Rod Hoedown is the next one in the pile here. This was an attempt in the early 60s to cash in on the then-popular youth trends. GMHH failed due to its over-ambitiousness. Kids of the time were interested in beatnik culture, custom cars, folk music, and the famous monsters of filmland, but had no desire to see them all combined into one poorly drawn magazine. The adventures of Hot Wheels of Dracula, his beatnik folk-singing girlfriend Finky Frankenstein, and the jive-talking invisible mechanic Transparent Thompson lasted only 2 issues. Federico Fellini Funnies is up next. Ambitious and artfully conceived, this doomed 1980s title used the Italian filmmaker's own storyboards as a model for bi-monthly comic book adaptations of such legendary films as Roma, 8½, and La Strada. Each issue would also feature an interview with a different Fellini actor, mail-in premiums that were refundable for discounts on Criterion Collection videotapes, and illustrated mini-essays by leading film critics. Unfortunately, this left very little money in the budget, and the art and drawing chores were handed over to Jack Chick. Dr. Q was conceived as an answer book to comics legend Steve Ditko's notorious Mr. A comics, in which a hardcore objectivist hero dispenses vigilante justice against various philosophical straw men. Dr. Q was presented as the world's first post-structuralist superhero, and along with his gorgeous fiancée, Ariel Gray, Dr. Q, in reality Ivy League ethics professor Stone Crab, battled terrorists, fanatics, and criminals by arguing with them over the arbitrary nature of human constructs and the malleable quality of language until they agreed to attend a series of lectures. My Truest Romance was considered at the time of its 1984 debut a highly promising gesture towards getting girls involved with comics. MTR was likewise a highly anticipated return of true romance comics and a very welcome overture to creator-run titles. Unfortunately, the wrong creator was put at the helm. Each one of artist-writer Taryn McDuffie's issues was a literally true retelling of her many disastrous breakups and subsequent institutionalizations for obsessive-compulsive disorder. Gangrenous Tunnel Fuck. This attempt by an American company to bring U.S.-style superhero action to the comic book-hungry Japanese public in 1985 seemed poised for success. It had terrific stories, unique and interesting plots and characters, top-notch artists were employed to reverse the trend of Japanese manga gobbling up market share. All of the quality talent involved in the project, however, came at the expense of hiring a decent translator. Benny Bums Rush tipped in 1956. This poor little rich boy title attempted to capitalize on the runaway success of rival Richie Rich. Where the richest kid in the world came across as friendly and helpful, however, little Benny Bums Rush was arrogant, overprivileged, and intolerant, ending every adventure by ordering his robotic butler Codswallop to deliver a brutal beating to a transient, a mental patient, or a menial laborer. The additional inexplicable decision to print a full page each issue of recent bankruptcy declarations proved embarrassing to many children. Man Spider. This was the story of an awkward and socially inept teenage spider who attained incredible human-like powers as the result of exposure to radioactivity. It featured stories and characters that would have been uniquely realistic and identifiable were they not directly copied from the previous month's issue of Spider-Man and redrawn with arachnids as the heroes rather than humans. Marvel's lawyers put an end to the title shortly after the first appearance of Octodoctopus. Sergeant Sissy. This is a World War II title featuring the comical adventures of the pansiest man in the Marine Corps. It proved to be a popular comic in 1941 and 1942, as readers got a break from the often grim wartime news by laughing at the incompetence of the effeminate, easily injured Jarhead. Its popularity dipped when, in 1943, the February issue was entitled Surrender to Superior Hero Soldier of Nippon, which was confiscated by the U.S. government. The entire run of the book was discovered to be the result of Japanese propaganda saboteurs. Finally, we have astonishing science fiction. After seeing its star-studded, gorgeously drawn cover, thousands of kids ponied up their dimes to get the debut issue of this 1957 comic. As it turned out, however, the book merely featured an astronomer, Dr. Techno, whose imaginary nature justified the title's use of the word fiction, explaining in great detail why the adventures of all their favorite superheroes were physically impossible. The book was canceled after the low sales of issue number 2, in which Dr. Techno explained that young Kal-El of Krypton would either have been mangled to death while attempting to reach escape velocity or starved while drifting forever in the empty void of space. Well, it's time once again for Celebrities Are Betters, and that can only mean one thing this week, and that's the royal wedding. Aristocrat celebrities, well, they're better than celebrities. They're like super celebrities. They're like the wellspring from whence celebrities came. You know, we have in America, we have celebrities instead of aristocrats. And in Britain, they have aristocrats instead of a giant hole that they throw money into. So let's go straight to some of the royal wedding coverage, because it's just too fabulous to be believed and a great reminder that we are not as important as other people. Let's see. Us Magazine has some great quotes from other celebrities about the royal wedding because, you know, I mean, they need to remind themselves that there are people more important than them, too, as hard as that is to believe. What did domestic diva Martha Stewart, 69, think of the romantic ceremony? The trees in the aisle were the perfect touch, and the landau in which they were riding is amazing, with one rider and four horses. The cavalry guard is beautiful, the horses are frisky, and the tack is fantastic. That's quite a lot of interest in horses there, Martha Stewart. British pop star Natasha Bedingfield, 29, was equally impressed with the decor. Love that the Abbey looks like Lord of the Rings with the trees inside. She told her nearly 100,000 Twitter followers. I'm so happy for William and Catherine, said Real Housewives of New York City star Luann de Lesseps, 45. Weddings make me emotional, said Jessica Lowndes, 22, of 90210. All this orchestra music makes me want to go to Disneyland. Is that weird? Nothing you do is weird. It's perfectly acceptable for you to want to go to Disneyland, Jessica Lowndes. It's your birthright. Meanwhile, over at People Magazine, we are informed that there will be no honeymoon right away. In an article that it took two people to write, we learned that after spending the first night of their married life at Buckingham Palace, following an evening of partying, the newlyweds were seen strolling the palace grounds hand in hand, thanking staff before they were whisked away by helicopter. And while she may be royalty now, the Duchess made a very down-to-earth footwear decision. She wore the same wedges Saturday morning as she did for her wedding rehearsal just a few days before. See, that shows you how normal, even though they are like orders of magnitude better than we are, this shows you how down-to-earth and regular these people really are, because here she is, a member of the most expensive royal family in the world, and she wears the same shoes more than one time. You know, it's just, she might as well be chewing tobacco, you know? But what of their top secret honeymoon? The Duke and Duchess of Cambridge have chosen not to depart for a honeymoon immediately, the palace said in a press release. It's the palace being referred to as if it's a person. Instead, after spending the weekend privately in the United Kingdom, the Duke will return to work as a search and rescue pilot next week, presumably wearing the same shoes that he used last time. The locations of both their private weekend and their future honeymoon, which will be overseas, will not be disclosed in advance. A source tells People Prince Charles pulled out of Clarence House around 10 a.m. in his Aston Martin and zipped over to Buckingham Palace to see the couple off. He looked very pleased. Well, what would he have to be pleased about, really? It's okay. Let's go on to E! Magazine. E! Wants to tell us that Kate's transformation to Queen has already begun. It's a transformation. Doesn't just, you know, it's not just, she's not the same person now. She's been transformed, just like when you put a piece of bread in your mouth that turns into the body of Christ. The special wedding tea towels may say Kate, but they're calling her Catherine now. These commoners sure move fast, already switching to their future queen's full birth name now that she's a royal and all. They actually used commoners in an unironic way there. Good job, E. Actually, it's Her Royal Highness, Catherine, Duchess of Cambridge, since we're getting all proper and all just 24 hours after she became a princess. So what's this dropping of Kate all about? Has she gone all queenie on us already? No, not like that. It's royal protocol. I'd imagine the Queen calls her Catherine, said native South Londoner Steve Hodge. Her friends will probably still call her Kate. William probably has a pet name for her. I wonder what that would be. Hodge said that although the tabloid papers across the UK will still refer to them as Wills and Kate. Woo! Thank God. That's over the day she turned queen. It will be Queen Catherine from there on out. Oh, hurry up and die already, Charles and existing queen. According to Londoner Chris Montgomery, it'll be all about what class you're in this city. A lot of the clued-up posher class will call her Catherine now. Others outside the country and most commoners will still call her Kate. And Londoner Paul David, who honors royal tradition. Good for you, Londoner Paul David. That'll get you some rewards in heaven. Breaks down exactly when the transformation to Kate from Kate to Catherine took place. It's Catherine now. She turned up in a car, but left in a carriage. She turned up as Kate and left as Catherine. She was not saluted on her way in, but she was saluted on her way out. She's joined the royal establishment. She is Catherine, Duchess of Cambridge now. She's a royal and should be addressed as such. Also, she has divine right on her side now. Let's not forget that. Finally, over at my favorite celebrity magazine, OK, we have, of course, the ultimate concatenation of celebrities. Justin Bieber is excited about the royal wedding, just like everyone else. Despite having a busy schedule of touring in Australia, Justin tweeted his excitement about the royal nuptials. Congrats to William and Kate. Wow, that's... He does sound excited, doesn't he? Watch some of the royal wedding in the dressing room before the show. Looks like they needed a DJ, lol. Justin was not the only Bieber team member excited about the wedding. This is a good one, folks. Kenny Hamilton, Justin's bodyguard, tweeted that he wondered if Elton John would sing Candle in the Wind because it's his favorite song. Yeah, that would really liven up a wedding, wouldn't it? You know, having somebody sing a song about your dead mother. That would be a good way to do it. Congratulations to you, Kenny Hamilton, bodyguard of Justin Bieber, for wrapping up this installment of Celebrities Are Our Betters. All right. Welcome back to the Petardcast. Joining me this week as our special guest is Mr. Steve Huey. How are you, Steve?
I'm good. How are you, Leonard?
I'm doing fine. It's
great.
It's about 99 degrees out, so I'm enjoying the cool weather and getting ready to start a period of well-earned unemployment.
Ah, that's what I mean right now. Well-earned unemployment.
God bless you. You want to identify yourself for a theoretical audience? Tell the listeners who you are and what you do.
My name is Steve Huey. I was the host of the popular internet cult program Yacht Rock, which gave me a springboard into becoming a talking head for VH1 shows. For example, the 100 Greatest Hard Rock Hits, 100 Greatest One-Hit Wonders of the 80s, 100 Greatest... there's a lot of them in there. There's a lot of 100 Greatest Things. They're all 5 hours long.
Mm-hmm.
If you watch them all back-to-back, you're a braver man than I.
Well, I think I speak for most viewers of those shows in saying that they're usually the preferred viewing for when you're hungover and they're on VH1 and you don't feel like changing the channel.
Yeah, that seems to be where a lot of people have seen me. The feedback that I get from old friends who catch me on television, it's usually on a weekend when nobody is doing much of anything, or they've gotten home from work and they're just dead tired. Or they're home for the holidays and trying to avoid their families.
Right. Well, you also, my understanding is that you just got back from Taiwan.
Yes, I was just at the beginning of April. I went to Taiwan for about a week and a half to visit an old friend from high school who was getting married to a nice Taiwanese girl.
Amazing. And what is going on over in Taiwan?
Well, in Taiwan, the capitalist system is working pretty well. They have a very strong wedding industry, which will extract the maximum amount of money from anyone who can afford to have a wedding. Out here in LA, we have it's a pretty relaxed environment for motorcycles because they can kind of go in between lanes and dart between cars with impunity. And in Taiwan, it's a lot like that for scooters. Everybody rides a scooter around the streets of Taiwan, except that there are about 10 times more of them than there are motorcycles in L.A. So anytime somebody pulls up to a red light by themselves, by the time the light changes, there will be this army of scooters that have surrounded the car. And as soon as the light changes, about 30 or 40 of them speed on ahead. And you just kind of have to do your best to avoid them. They don't necessarily behave as though they are physically vulnerable. Yeah, I wasn't in China for very long. I had a layover at the Beijing airport. I flew L.A. to Beijing and then Beijing to Taipei. And while my first layover in Beijing on my way there, I had to go through an airport security checkpoint, like a TSA-type carry-on baggage scan.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know why, because I'd just gotten off a plane, and I clearly had not blown it up with anything that was in my luggage, but that's the rule, apparently.
Yep.
So I send my bag through, and there's a water bottle in it, because I just flew across the Pacific Ocean, and flying dehydrates you. And I don't realize, you can't take water through here, even though you just brought it off the plane that you didn't blow up. And so they take the water bottle out of my bag, and this girl, this security staffer, there's about 20 of them all milling around, but this security staffer walks up and says, "We have to rescan your bag." So she takes it out of my sight, back around the x-ray machine. I've already been through the scanner. She takes it back around. The bag comes back. I walk away with it. I open it up about 5 minutes later to rearrange some stuff. And, oh, wait a minute. That little bag where I had my camera and my iPod is not in there anymore. They attempted to convince me that I left it on the plane, mm-hmm. which worked until I'd had a few hours to wake up and think about it. Like, no. As paranoid as I am about my electronics, especially being able to hold all my music in the palm of my hand, there's very, very little likelihood that I would have not noticed that was not in my bag when I got off the plane.
Yeah, brittle.
So the moral of the story is that communists are assholes.
Well, yeah, that's how they get you, you know.
And that's why communism doesn't work, is that people want consumer electronic goods.
Yeah, and communism forces them to steal them instead of earning them by the sweat of your brow.
Exactly. If they just worked harder, they would be able to afford them.
Yeah, or just, you know, they could steal them from the plant where they manufacture them for our benefit, you know.
Yeah, you would think that they would have gotten a piece of brain like that and just, you know, you don't have to take somebody else's. You can just take one that hasn't even been sold yet.
Is there anything irreplaceable on your iPod?
Luckily, no. It's just a pain in the ass to spend the money on replace. I mean, because, of course, I'm a huge music nerd, so I have the 160 gigabyte model.
Right, yeah.
Which is the most expensive. Although I think it's come down in price since I bought the first one. I can't remember. But I hope at least that the person who stole it is going to look through how much music on there and think,
appreciate,
wow.
Yeah,
this is some awesome, this is 160 gigabytes of awesome American music in a language I don't understand or care about.
Yeah, they'll know that they stole the iPod of a classy, tasteful guy, you know.
Exactly.
I always have sort of the opposite fear. I fear if I ever get mugged, you know, and somebody takes my iPod or, like, I leave it in the car and they steal it out of my car or whatever, that they'll hold me in contempt because they'll go, this guy listens to a bunch of weird bullshit. You know, like, who is this guy? It was fucking, you know, crazy, you know, obscure music that nobody likes on his iPod, you know.
Yeah, I had a car broken into once because I stupidly left a CD player in plain view. And I only had this is back before I had an actual car stereo with a CD player in it.
Mm-hmm.
But I had two pieces of music in the car. I had an Andrew WK CD, and I had a cassette tape of REO Speedwagon's Greatest Hits.
Nice.
And the thief took the Andrew WK CD, but left the REO Speedwagon tape. And I've never been able to figure out, did he leave it because of the format it was on or because of the content? It's an interesting question.
He should have driven it back to that same location and left it open again with a note.
Dear thief, why did you leave the REO Speedwagon tape?
Yeah, you could even have written a little defense of REO Speedwagon, you know? Because if you don't like them, here, let me ask you to reconsider. So how are things in L.A. these days?
The weather's lovely. I am unemployed for the time being. I'll be going back to work. Supposedly, I'll be going back to work on a reality show as an assistant editor in about a month or so. You can never take that for granted. The last time I had some time off of work, the reality show I had been working on was called Megan Wants a Millionaire. And you may remember that was the show where one of the contestants ended up murdering his ex-wife and trying to flee to Canada back about a year and a half ago, 2 years or so, maybe. So there was no more work at that company for a while. VH1 was not very happy with the way that all went down.
Well, you didn't have anything to do with it, though, right?
Oh, no. I was just collateral damage. Because, well, yeah, they yanked that show off the air, and the other one the company shot that had him in it, and suddenly there were not nearly as many jobs at that company anymore.
Yeah, well, you give the reality show industry a few years, and that's going to become a feature rather than a drawback.
Oh, yeah, I mean, the way that you get on a reality TV show is that you demonstrate that you may create conflict.
Mm-hmm.
And the people who are the most efficient at generating conflict out of thin air are the nut jobs.
Right.
Because if you have no conflict, you have no storyline. It's like screenwriting 101, which applies even to reality shows. So producers love people who can create conflict.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was reading something about Ice-T is going to have a new reality show. It's going to be him and his wife, Coco, the beloved internet breast sensation, Coco. And
that one internet breast sensation.
Right. Well, the one who's married to Ice-T. And he promises that there's not going to be any drama on his show. And I'm like, why is anybody going to watch it then?
Yeah, that's a fundamental misreading of the genre.
Yeah, that's maybe he'll bring in Flavor Flav, you know, to spice things up, and as his ratings.
Flav has to be looking for work. I heard his fried chicken restaurant closed down already.
Yeah, I'm kind of wondering if putting a fried chicken restaurant owned by Flavor Flav in Iowa maybe was not a bit of a miscalculation.
I feel like there are better target markets for a business venture like that.
Yeah, I mean, in New York or L.A., you're going to have a lot of people coming in just for the novelty of it, you know?
Right, because, yeah, everybody in New York and L.A., especially in L.A., likes the novelty of going to a celebrity-owned establishment, because maybe he'll be there.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe that celebrity, since the celebrity lives in that town, maybe he will be there eating.
Especially if it's Flavor Flav. He hasn't
right.
got
I
much
can't
else
imagine
going
Flavor
on.
Flav wants to spend a whole lot of time in Iowa.
Right. Yeah, well, I'm sure it will all end in lawsuits and tears, but...
Or at least lawsuits.
Yeah. And there's another reality show for you, you know? It's...
Oh, yeah, they should get on that.
Yep. Well, are you ready to have a dialogue?
Let's have a dialogue, Leonard.
All right, let's do that. In rock and roll hell, there's 100 guys who all want to join your band, and they're all drummers.
In rock and roll hell, the three most commonly used words on your band's internet message board are authenticity, hipster, and pederast.
In rock and roll hell, there's a dozen critics in attendance at every gig you play, and 11 of them give you a pan. The one who gives you a rave is Dave Marsh.
In rock and roll hell, you keep losing band members to drugs, but they're really embarrassing drugs like model cement and Dexatrim.
In rock and roll hell, you have to go to church every single morning for worship service and gospel music. But since it's hell, all the gospel music is French black metal.
I don't know, that sounds like a pretty sweet church.
I know, well, it does to me too, but...
There's some Deathstrel Omega in there. Yeah. In rock and roll hell, the first name in the Great American Songbook is Don Dokken. The last name in the Great American Songbook is also Don Dokken.
In rock and roll hell, you get a free practice pad, but it's a you store it, in Arizona, in August. And the band who practices in the space next to you is a Mr. Mr. cover band. That actually happened to me, by the way. It's a true story right there.
Did they play anything besides the two hits?
They did. They had their own material, but the Mr. Mr. cover songs were their best stuff.
Obviously.
Yeah.
All right. In rock and roll hell, sound checks last for 14 hours and are mandatory. Your band gets free drinks, though, as long as you like bull shots.
In rock and roll hell, you still age. When you arrive, you're 18, and your band is opening for six other groups, all of whom have better-looking girlfriends. When you turn 30, your band is the headliner after eight other bands on a Tuesday night, and you have to work the next day, and your crummy-looking girlfriend just had a baby.
In rock and roll hell, your next album is being produced by Axl Rose, who intends to get it right this time and not rush things the way he did with Chinese Democracy.
In rock and roll hell, everyone uses the word fusion.
In rock and roll hell, you have your choice of starting out as the bassist of an all-black screwdriver cover band or the vocalist of an all-date rapist bikini kill cover band.
In rock and roll hell, there's a vital and lively debate going on between the proponents of the leading styles, but the styles are screamo and doo-wop revival.
In rock and roll hell, the devil makes every band sing his favorite song to him twice a day. His favorite song is The Devil Went Down to Georgia, and he sings along with his part.
In rock and roll hell, the club owners always pay you on time, but they pay you in chicken wings.
In rock and roll hell, your roommate is a well-known performer who's already made it and has connections in the business. It's Gigi Allen.
In rock and roll hell, everyone is required to use rock as a verb while on stage at least three times per performance and to have at least one song in their repertoire that explicitly refers to rock. Also roll.
That sounds like regular rock and roll.
It does, yeah.
In rock and roll hell, whenever a record company A&R rep comes to see your band, your cooler is out of Diet Coke. Also, the rep is from Atlantic Records.
In rock and roll hell, it's not only the same six friends at every one of your shows, it's the same six friends at every one of everyone's shows. In this way, rock and roll hell is even worse than theater hell or performance art hell. But of course, performance art hell has performance art, so there's that.
In rock and roll hell, the Brill Building is still open for business, supplying songs to girl groups. However, all the songs are written by Alanis Morissette. Also, Alanis Morissette sings all the lead and harmony parts for every girl group. In rock and roll hell, classic rock radio doesn't play Led Zeppelin every 10 minutes anymore. Unfortunately, they do play Canned Heat every 10 minutes. In rock and roll hell, Ayn Rand concept albums are recorded by every heavy metal band. All the Tolkien and Lovecraft concept albums are recorded by Rush.
Kelly County Sheriff's Department Hate Crimes Desk, duty log. 4:05 p.m., Margaret Willoughby, Cotter's Junction. called to report some kids knocked over her mailbox with a baseball bat and wanted to know, was that a hate crime? Informed her it was not. She explained that mailbox contained fundraising letter from Hispanic televangelist. Told her the kids probably didn't know that. She asked, what kind of crime is it then? Said it was just a regular crime. Harold Yang, Elderville, 5:11 p.m. Called to report that a guy bought some shrimp lo mein and run off with the takeout order without paying. Told him wasn't sure that was a hate crime. Informed me that he was born in Hong Kong. Said I knew that, but running off with takeout without paying isn't really a hate crime as such, even if it's Chinese takeout. He asked, well, what if the guy called him a dirty slope as he ran off? Then would it be a hate crime? Told him yes, possibly. Did the guy do that? He said no, but just wanted to know for future reference in case it happened. He wanted to be prepared. Said it was always helpful to be prepared. He said, how's about I prepare you some chicken satay? Said, nice segue, but no thanks. 5:35 p.m. Bobby, no last name given, but it was Bobby Carteret. You can tell from the way he pronounces his R's funny. Wheaton. Called to ask if it was a hate crime to beat up a nigger. Told him yes, and it's also a hate crime to call somebody that. He asked, well, what about a queer? Said yes. He asked, well, what about that Jew boy who runs a satellite TV store? Said yes, Bobby, that too. He said, well, goddammit, who can I beat up without getting into even more trouble because Terry Letcher run off with my riding lawnmower and I'm pissed as hell. Told him not that I'm condoning violence or anything, but your best bet would probably be beating up Terry Letcher. He said, but he's a redhead. Told him that doesn't count as a hate crime. He said, okay, and hung up. Called Jimmy in car 22 and told him to head on over to Terry Letcher's farm. 6:06 p.m., Anna Marie Lindsdorf, Butler. Called to say she does too. Said, you do too what? She said, I'm calling the hotline to say me too. I said, me too what? She said, what? I said, what? She said, what? I said, I'm not really following you here, Mrs. Lindsdorf. She said, this is the hate crime hotline, isn't it? I said, yes'm. She said, well, I'm just calling to say that I also hate crime. Said, oh, I see. She said, crime, criminals, gangs, the drugs, I hate them all. And I just wanted to say, keep up the good work. Thought about correcting her, but decided it wasn't worth it. 7:41 p.m., Terry Letcher, Wheaton. Called to say Bobby Carteret just beat the shit out of him with a hoe for no reason than he borrowed his riding lawnmower and it was a hate crime. Said you can report it to Jimmy, but it wasn't a hate crime. He said, bullshit it ain't. He told me he hates me like four times. Told him it's not a hate crime, it's just Bobby Carteret beating your ass like he does every 2 days or so because you're both a couple of drunks who are always stealing each other's stuff and maybe this wouldn't happen so often if you sobered up and got jobs. He said this officer's response to him was itself a hate crime. Told him no, it wasn't either. He said, what if I convert to Judaism? Can I get some hate crime action then? Told him, yeah, that would be okay, but it would only cover future beatings after your conversion, and he couldn't get any credit for retroactive hate crimes. He said he'd have to think about it. 8:29 p.m., Manur al-Ismail, Curtis Town. Called to report that a bunch of dudes come into his gas station and whooped him with a crowbar, calling him a towelhead and chanting, USA, go back to Muzzy Arabia, and was that a hate crime? Said yes it was and got very excited about first ever actual hate crime reported in 3-year history of this department. Took down vital information about time and place of crime until caller informed this officer that he worked at IP Freely's Gas Emporium at 1234 Dumbass Avenue. Took rest of night off. Well, that about puts the last nail in the coffin that is this week's Petardcast. We surely thank you for joining us and hope that you've gotten more out of it than we put into it, which, frankly, wasn't very much. We greatly appreciate Mr. Hollywood Steve Huey for joining us for this audio comedic romp stompery. Catch him in heavy rotation on VH1, follow him on Twitter, where he is Hollywood Steve H, or check him out at yachtrock.com. The Petardcast is perennially grateful to Mr. Hayden Childs of North Kakalaka for the theme song. If you're interested in appearing on this show, write us at guests@ludiclive.com or drop us a line of a more general nature at info@ludiclive.com. If you enjoy the show or you just like leaving comments about things, why not head to the iTunes Music Store and leave a comment on our page? That's the place to sign up for free subscriptions to this program and listen live whenever you want on ludiclive.com. That's LudicLive.com. This episode is dedicated to Aleister Crowley and Verrier, Prince of Principalities. Please stop by 2 weeks from today for more comedy, more interviews, and more pops and clicks than a melted wax cylinder. As wide as a trailer and as deep as your failure, this is your Petardcast.